And I'm very conscious, being back in Oxford, that 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago, I finished a thesis here writing about how people in the Soviet Union had fought in the Second World War and adapted to civilian life after the war, the process of demobilization. And I had the very good fortune, immediately as I finished that thesis, to stumble into a job at International Alert and to set up a program for what we then called conflict resolution in the former Soviet Union, and particularly in the Caucasus, just as the war in Abkhazia was breaking out. And that's actually a context that's, I suppose, dominated my life since. And sort of looking back at that time, a couple of us were just reflecting at lunch that in a way the 90s were a bit of a boom period for conflict resolution, peace building, and the 20s, our current decade, feels a bit like a doom period with the sort of unholy trinity of COVID, conflicts, and climate change dominating our thinking. And so what I'm going to reflect on a little bit in my presentation is less of the wonderfully eloquent reflections that we had this morning, but perhaps a slightly more prosaic perspective of what does it mean to be involved in running a peacebuilding organization? And so in a way, I stand here as a what I see as a peacebuilding bureaucrat, sadly. I'm less doing the hands-on work these days, but hopefully doing a reasonably good job to facilitate a fantastic team of 80 colleagues who are out there doing the peacebuilding work and engaging with communities and contexts and complexity in those endeavors, and working with, at any given time, 60 to 80 partner organizations living the conflicts that they're trying to transform. And I'm extraordinarily conscious that the work that we do, and when I think about trying to answer this question, who builds peace, that the people who build peace are the people who, I think of people who are doing, on one level, ordinary, and on another level, extraordinary work on a daily basis. And tragically, who too often give their lives for this. A very dear friend of mine just dropped dead last November, younger than me, 52, but he had worked himself to an early grave. Others, and we all know them, have been killed in the pursuit of trying to build peace. And I think, you know, we need to reflect that it is a high stakes endeavor to try and build peace, not just in political or legal terms, but in terms of life and death. And I'm more conscious than ever that this is a work of many hands. Building peace is not something that you do alone. And there are many angles to it. So I speak from a perspective of Conciliation Resources, peace building, mediation support, NGO. But I'm very conscious that we do this in what, I mean, John Paul this morning used the term ecosystem. And I was thinking of using it in terms of the ecosystem in which we operate alongside intergovernmental organizations, multilateral organizations, government, states, non-state armed groups, and civil society in its manifold existence, and the sorts of organizations to movements, activists, to bureaucrats who pursue this effort. And I think of the words of my friend and colleague Andy Carl, who founded Conciliation Resources 28 years ago. And Andy had a mantra that the people most affected and often most insightful about what needs to be done to address conflict are often the least well-resourced to do so. And in some ways, that's how Andy came up with what many people consider the strange name Conciliation Resources. And I think this idea of how do you provide resources to the people who are most exposed, most vulnerable, but also most invested in change, how do you provide them resources to enable them to do this in a sustained way? Now, in recent years, quite rightly, the discourse around local peace building has become very powerful, and it's a very dynamic one, and I think critical to our understanding of what it is we're all involved in. But I also think it's really important that we don't make a fetish of the notion of the local. On the one hand, I find it sometimes can be terribly patronizing to talk of local peace builders, and then these internationals who come in. On one level, we're all local, and we should be very wary of that dichotomy. But I also think that it touches on what John Paul spoke about when he spoke about the dichotomy between inside and partial mediators and outside neutral actors. I hope we've learned that the outsider multi-partial actor is not neutral about the violations and the abuses and the butchery that they witness. But if you choose to be a peace builder, if you choose to support processes of mediation, you do sometimes have to step back and not take sides. And that can be painful, can be uncomfortable, but you need to think about what's your role, what's your contribution. But I also want to think about the term local on another level. The societies that become immersed in conflict do so for a myriad of different reasons. Geopolitics has been mentioned, and I think that's a powerful driver, and it's one that is on some levels inescapable. I was in an event last weekend with someone who used the term the geopolitical squeeze, and I think it's a very powerful one. But at the same time, those people who are striving for change within conflict-ridden societies, they are often asking for, they need external support. Societies get enmeshed in conflict because, unfortunately, of the dysfunctions that people within struggle to resolve on their own. So the question is, how do you bring support from outside in a respectful, meaningful way that sustains effective peace building? And one of the things that we think about very deeply at our organization is the question of what is meaningful and effective partnership in the peace building sphere. And in some ways, I think that relationship between the people whose conflict it is, who are trying to transform their conflict, and the people from outside, how they work together, that relationship is part of the alchemy of what it is to build peace. So when I ask myself who builds peace, I think of the multiple partnerships that we're involved in. And a few years ago, we did some research to try and unpack what our understanding of partnership in peace building is. There's been a lot of work on partnership in multiple spheres. And we want to think, what does it mean for us as a peace building organization? And we came up with four findings that I think were very important for our sense of who we are as an organization. So I want to share those with you and then talk a little bit about some of the specific contributions that can be made. One is what we call an accompaniment approach. And we think this is particularly suited to what we recognize as being long-term and adaptive peace building, around the genuine commitment to working with people, but to co-creating what it is you do and the strategies that are designed and developed, and really genuinely thinking about what does it mean to provide the space that gets beyond outputs and deliverables that all too often get talked about to focus on the change. Secondly, I think there's a question around the diverse set of relationships with different organizations that have different mandates and profiles. And that can be a real strength in peace building when you have partners who amplify each other's strengths and when you have a genuine consideration for what complementarity means. Thirdly, we're conscious that there's a balance between remote partnering and being present. We don't have offices in all the contexts where we work, we do in some. And we always have to think, why are we there? What are we seeking to achieve in being there? And how do we navigate the politics, which is essential for the people within their own societies building peace, but it's also essential for you as an outsider coming in. You bring reputational challenges for your partners. You bring questions around the privileged access that you as an outsider, as an international, often have. And how does that jeopardize what people within their own societies do? And how do you use that privileged access in the interests of people within society, not within your own interests? And that takes a lot of choreography and intent to ensure that unheard voices and marginalized voices get given due recognition. And then fourthly, I think there's an issue around balancing the contractual aspects of partnership and the aspiration and activism for change. On the one level, as an outside organization that often has the funds channeled through you, there's a question of being able to act as a buffer to insulate people within conflict regions from some of the complex and competing demands imposed by donors. But you have to balance that with making sure that it's not your agenda you're working to, that you're really listening to the agendas of the people who are seeking change with their own society. And then I think this question of how you navigate the overly prescriptive approaches of donors, be it in the increasingly arduous compliance and regulatory domain that we constantly have to struggle with, be it the results-based monitoring and evaluation that is so often out of tune with the non-linear nature of conflict in volatile contexts. These are things that become a joint struggle, but the truth is, oftentimes as an organization based in London or wherever it might be, you're dealing with this constantly. Whereas if you're working with a community group in Northern Central African Republic, it's a discourse that they have no experience of. And so you can become the translator of how to deal with these sorts of issues. But we had, and hopefully we use this role to also try and influence the donors to think about how they use their resources and how they use their influence to bring about change, to try and change some of these often absurd approaches. Can't say we've been hugely successful to date, but that's another story. So what is it that an NGO like ours brings to the process of peace when we work with colleagues in conflict contexts? Of course, it'll vary from organization to organization, and it will vary from context to context. But I want to just think of four that I hope we try and do well. One is bringing comparative experience. We work in some 20 contexts. We also produce a journal called Accord on practice of building peace and what is effective, what is less effective. So we bring a lot of comparative experience to the table. And I was reminded in one of the breaks this morning talking with John Alderdice that when John was Speaker of the Assembly in Northern Ireland in the early 2000s, we brought several groups of Georgian and Abkhaz civic and political actors to Belfast to try and give them a different perspective on security, economic, cultural, political issues as they impacted on their context. And John shared his vision of how you move from violence to politics as a means to address conflict. And that was a very powerful notion for our Georgian and Abkhaz colleagues. And so being able to bring that comparative perspective, and one has to be careful with study visits because they've become a bit of a go-to tool over the years and they can be a waste of money sometimes. You've really got to think about them in a thoughtful, planned way to make them useful. But I also think about the comparative experience you can bring. For instance, Tanya mentioned work we're doing in the Somali regional state of Ethiopia, where we've been involved for more than a decade. And it's actually one of the situations where we had the good fortune to help the signing of a peace agreement. And that doesn't happen very often, I have to say. But we're now working with colleagues there on efforts to look at how victims can influence the process of transitional justice. And we brought those colleagues into contact with people doing this in a variety of different places so they can see what's useful for them and what lessons they might want to learn. A second role after the comparative experience is that I think as an outsider, you can play a really important role in supporting to bridge divides. This can be very hard for insiders to do alone. Sometimes the structure of a conflict just makes it impossible. Now I think of work that I've been intimately involved in the Georgian Abkhaz conflict, where you couldn't just walk across the divide. You did need some kind of external facilitation to bring people together. Likewise in Kashmir. So in both those contexts, we've been involved in long-standing dialogue initiatives across the conflict divide, but actually initiatives of multiple levels, bringing people together in political dialogue, bringing people together in educational initiatives, in Kashmir, facilitating a long-standing but currently blocked process of a joint chamber of commerce and industry, the only cross line of control body that has existed in Kashmir. And this has been us as outsiders being able to play that facilitative role to bring people together. I think of connections within societies that are fragmented. So I've got colleagues in the Central African Republic at the moment working on what we call a decentralized dialogue, recognizing the dilemmas that were spoken of earlier of the center and the peripheries of states, and how do you bridge those divides? And we find that our partners in the Central African Republic need external support to facilitate that. Alone, they've not been able to raise the resources or the access to make it happen. So through partnership, we brought it to a new level. Thirdly, I think about the way we can provide challenge and spaces where people can think differently. And I think that one of the elements of that is, how do you make the process of change less exclusive? How do you bring different voices in that might not have that opportunity? And again, our work with the ONLF in Ogaden, I think, has been quite instructive for us on that. And then a fourth area where I think we bring a lot, and it's been spoken about earlier today, is this question of access to resources and the nature of financing peace building, which in so many ways is demanding and inadequate. And there are challenges around financial cycles that John Paul spoke about, 10-year funding. Well, those of you who are involved in peace building know that's a holy grail. And you know what we do, and I think of our experience of working in a Georgian Abkhaz context for 30 years, 25 years at CR, 5 years beforehand, we have to piece together a mosaic of funding, and you're constantly trying to bridge gaps and keep the resources going so you don't lose momentum in the initiatives, and that you don't projectize what you're doing, that you are thinking strategically. Well, the funding environment makes that really hard. And we have to constantly ask ourselves, are we diverting resources from people in the context who are trying to bring about change, or are we adding value? So what makes this work happen? What's the glue? We've heard a lot about relationships today, and quite rightly. John Paul spoke about curiosity, humility, and patience. I'd add to that durability, empathy, and generosity. I think the commitment to being there through fallow times is critical to building the credibility to be able to play a role. I think questions of coordination and complementarity are essential. Undoubtedly, NGOs tread on one another's toes. But I think where we stand today compared to when I got involved 30 years ago, let alone 10 years ago, the collaboration and the coordination between multiple organizations has moved on enormously. And I think there's a lot further to go, but I'm heartened by the way I see people working together. Tanya spoke about successes and failures. And clearly, we don't always achieve what we're striving for. But we do know that commitment to stay engaged in processes is imperative. And to do this, we need to navigate the politics. And as Andre rightly emphasized, peace building is fundamentally political. Too many donors talk about people-to-people engagement as if you can detach it from the politics of a situation. And David Bloomfield, speaking about reconciliation in a publication of ours a few years ago, said that people think reconciliation is soft. And I would apply that to people-to-people diplomacy. They think it's soft, it's easy. You can bring that into a process that's protracted and intractable. Our job is to find traction. And reconciliation and people-to-people engagement is not soft. It's the hardest thing imaginable. And in a world where we see governments throwing money at the militarized solutions of conflicts, we need to find a way back to those soft issues that are actually the essence of what peace building is. And so the final comment I'd make is that in running a peace building organization and being run by my colleagues much of the time, I think the critical dimension we have to hold on to is thinking about what our values are, what we stand for, and to ensure that we don't allow the transactional nature of relationships to surpass the transformative aspirations that we have in being involved in peace building. Thank you.